accession number 27065, reel number 3. Mr. James Blackburn, reel 3. We were talking about when you first joined F Troop, 452 Battery, 74th Field Regiment, near Cairo, just before you moved to Gaza. I wondered if there were any characters within the unit that particularly impressed yourself on you in the early days. I mean, off tape, you mentioned the colonel. Now, who was that? Tell us about him.
Well, it was a chap called Collett White. Actually, I saw his obituary in the paper.
Collett White or Wyatt?
White. In 1987.
And what was he like as a colonel?
Gave a telegram. Didn't see a lot of him, but I was up before him I got a week's pack drill.
Now, what was that for? Tell us that story.
Well, you had to, your vehicles every night had to be disabled, and the drill was that you took the lead off the battery. And I thought it seemed ridiculous, that did, you know, if anybody was going to pinch the vehicle, all they have to do is slap the lead back on and they'd be home and dry. So I rewired the ignition button to the horn button, you see, so that they would never think of that, I thought. And I thought it was disabled, you see. Well, of course, they came around inspecting them, found that mine wasn't disabled, the battery lead was still on. So I was up before the colonel. And I can see him now, his eyes, his sort of blue eyes, they looked at me as though to say, well, why do I have to deal with idiots like this when we're just about to have to face the German? But anyway, he gave me a week's back drill in the sun in the afternoon, you know, marching up and down for an hour.
Was it tough?
No, I quite enjoyed it, to be honest. You know, it seemed ridiculous, but it was something to do.
Was Collett White popular in the unit?
Well, he was known for his... he was a bit strict, and nobody fell foul of him if they could avoid it. But as far as I know, he wasn't disliked. He was... but he actually left not so long afterwards, and I can't for the life of me remember who took his place, the
now,
name of him.
What about your major, or your running 452 battery? Do you remember him?
There was a Major Dawson and Captain James, and there's a Captain Bainbridge and a Lieutenant Cochran, a Scotsman.
And what were these officers like?
Bainbridge was, I think he'd been wounded at Gazala, and he'd been, he was very sort of uptight, you know. But Cochran was a very nice chap, you know, he got on well with everybody.
He was your troop officer?
Cochran was, yes, that's right, yes. Yes, I liked him very much.
And what about your NCOs? I mean, who was... did you have an MT sergeant, or who was in charge of you?
Well, there was a Sergeant Thomas. And there was a Sergeant Asquith. Now, Sergeant Asquith was a chess player. And we used to play chess. And Bazique, he could play Bazique, I don't know if you've ever heard of that, on a regular basis, so that's got nothing to do with military matters, but...
That's how you spent your time?
We used to spend the time, so I rigged a little light up in the truck at night, and we'd be playing chess till midnight in the middle of the desert, quite often, at El Adam.
What about any other special friends? Any friends?
Well, I had a friend, a chap called Tom Parker.
A gunner, driver?
A gunner, yeah, driver, yes. Tom Parker, he was 34 as well. He was a lot older than me. And Wally Graves, he was a friend of mine.
What did you look for in a mate then? I mean, what, you know, what, because they're a bit older. Why them, not one of the other older ones? Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's difficult to say. I mean, it was just something that just got on with them, you see. I got on with Tom Parker the whole time, right through the war. It was just something that we just got on well together. And
was he it. Another quieter lad, not one of the drinking?
Yes, that's right, he was, yes.
Did you find things like swearing upset you? Because there is quite a bit of swearing in the army. Did that upset you? Or
No, never did, no.
Did you start swearing with all it?
No, I didn't, no, not really. No. I remember when we broke out from Alamein, we had to go down these roads.
I will come to that. That's running a bit ahead.
Okay.
Now, so you moved to Gaza.
Yeah.
Now, what was the setup at Gaza?
Well, we were just in a camp near, right next to the pyramids, actually, and we were just preparing really to go up to the line.
Did you prepare? What do you mean?
Well. Sort of getting everything together, I suppose. It was we weren't there long, but we knew that we were going to go up to Alamein any time.
Now, were you practicing things like desert driving? Because driving in sand, and well, not that all desert sand, there's also the rough desert. Did you do any practice in that zone there?
No, not really, no.
So you got
because. When you see these pictures of, sinking in the sand and all the rest of it, it was nothing like that. It was as hard as a tarmac road. Little scrubby bushes in among it. It was not at all like Bogest or, all the rest of it. It was...
Anything else happened while you were at Gaza? I mean, did you visit the pyramids?
Yes, just to see them, that was all. Didn't go up them or anything, no.
So what happened next then?
Well, we moved up. It was a sort of... We got the order to move up to go into action, as it were. And I shall never forget that day. There was a long column of vehicles going up, stretching as far along the road as you could see. And it's a funny sort of feeling, because you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, you've been in the army all that time and never been in action, and now you know that you're going to do it. And it was a strange feeling, because most of them, you see, had been in action. It was just us Queen Mary boys that were new to the job. So it didn't apply to everybody, but personally, and I suppose some of the others, it was a strange experience. You didn't quite know what to expect. I mean, they were talking about when they come back from Gazala, they'd been in boxes. I mean, Hawking Lake had arranged everybody in boxes and let the Germans come at them. It was a silly way of doing it, really. And so they expected it to be the same again, but of course it wasn't. Not when Montgomery took over.
So
anyway, we got up to the line, and the first thing, a chap came up on a motorbike and said, "Right, the enemy's 2,000 yards away." You know, that sort of brought it home to you. But
now, did you dig into gun positions then, or what were you doing?
Yes, you had to dig these gun pits.
Would you help with that?
Yes, I did, yeah.
So tell us what was a gun pit for a 25-pounder? How was it laid?
Well,
out?
It was we used to dig circular things, I was thinking about, 8 or 9 yards across. Hacked it out of this. It was rock, it was ever so hard. You know, you got pickaxes and goodness knows what. And it had to be done, so that was it. And put these guns in these pits and put camouflage netting over them.
And what type of camouflage did you have?
Well, it was, sandy sort of colour netting with sandy cloth tied to it and that sort of thing.
And where would you, did you have any covered shelter? Did you dig any dugouts?
We had to dig, you were supposed to dig a slip trench for yourself, you know, a personal slip trench.
How big would that be?
Well, it depended on what you felt about it, you know. I don't think I bothered, to be honest, but they told you to do it, but they didn't really enforce it.
Now, what about the quads? What was done about them? Were they dug in?
No, not really. They, we had them, they were sandbagged, the floor was all sandbagged on the floor of the quad, in case you ran over a mine or anything. But gradually, you used to find that the sand was too heavy, you know, it was, the vehicle was too heavy to manoeuvre properly with all that sand in it. So we took most of it out in the end, but we did sandbag it to start with.
But you didn't dig them in and sort of drive them into the...
No, not really. Tried to camouflage it as best we could with nets and things like that, but you sort of got the idea that nobody would come at you personally.
Now, whereabouts in the El Alamein positions were you?
Well, we were right at the south, opposite the Italians. I know we were opposite the Italians because when we actually broke out and drove through their position, there were big, great big coppers full of spaghetti. You know, they were still left. They'd left them as they'd been using them. But we were down in the 50th Division was... at the south end of the line, near the Qatari Depression.
So what was happening? You went there in August.
Yeah.
And
right.
So it's
that's
quite right. A couple of months before you were in the line.
That's right.
What were conditions like for you there? I mean, take us through a typical day.
Well, we used to parade in the morning. We used to stand in lines, and the officer... Cochrane, for instance, he would stand in front of us facing us and read out the orders for the day, whatever it might be. So you might be maintaining your vehicle or you might be doing various other things, digging trenches perhaps. Or, sanitary arrangements. There was a.
Tell us about that then.
Yeah, there was a. We used to have these petrol tins. All our petrol came in these square, sort of flimsy tins. Most of it had leaked out by the time we got them. Terrible thing. But we used to cut one of those in half and punch a hole in the bottom, bury it in the sand, and everybody had to urinate into that particular one. We used to call it the Desert Rose, you see. So you had to be a bit particular. You didn't just go anywhere round about the site. They had to have this desert rose.
And what about the other arrangement?
Well, they used to have a pit, dig a great big pit, and put a pole across the top. And that was it.
After morning parade, you'd have these various things, depending on what you'd been told to do.
Yes, but of course, after about... 11 o'clock, you were left more or less to yourself because it was too hot to do anything else much, and while there was nothing else doing. And we used to have a tiffin at midday, which was a light meal, and a substantial meal at night.
Now, what food did you get in the desert? Take us through that.
Well, there was a lot of curry. We had a lot of curry meat. With curry, we used to have a lot of curry.
Was it fresh meat or just curried bully?
I can't really remember that. It was eatable anyway.
Had they been in India, this unit?
Pardon?
Where was the...
Well, I think it was the fact that it was a hot country, you see. And the meat, you didn't, if it was going off slightly, the curry hid it. You know, it was acceptable, perhaps. But the funny thing was, we used to have this tiffin at midday and the meal at night, and we carried on doing that right through to the end of the war, even in England and Europe, in this regiment, in our regiment.
You got used to
it. We still had tiffin at the middle of the day. And
so what that might the light meal be, what might tiffin be?
Well, that I can't remember, to be honest.
But in the evening?
It wasn't much.
In the evening, a curry?
Well, there was often curry with it, yes.
What about
we did have corned beef quite a bit, yes, corned beef.
What about the water or tea, you know, I mean, what
yes,
did you
we
drink?
Yes, we had tea. They used to boil plenty of tea. That was, if you were hot like we were, a cup of hot tea was marvellous for cooling you down. I've always noticed that. I've always believed in that. Here even, I would never drink cold drinks when you're hot. I always have hot tea. And it was just the same in the desert. The more hot tea we could get, the better.
Was army tea distinctive in any way? Because they always talk about it being different. Very sweet.
Well, you mean got some... what's the name in it?
Broma. No, I don't really mean that. That's a bit of a myth, I think. No, yes, I really mean just the taste of it.
I don't remember it, no. Don't remember that. No. But
who would do the brewing up?
Well, there was like a cookhouse. You know, there was a tent. Especially organised as a cookhouse.
So they'd do most of that?
Yeah. I remember doing it myself once, cooking the... we used to have, for fires, we had these half petrol tins full of sand, and the sand was soaked in petrol, and the dixies that we had were put on top of that, you see, to cook. And I can't remember why I was doing it, but I was cooking, boiling this tea, and the fire had gone out, or I thought it had. So I got a can of petrol and poured it on. And of course, it blew straight back into my face and burnt all my face. So I was, it all, you know, blistered and everything. And I was in a bad way for about 3 or 4 days. But I got over it.
Now, was much happening in this period between August and October? Or was it just this routine?
Well, it was more or less a routine.
Was there a regiment in action?
What we used to do, when it got dark, we used to go off into the desert about 3 or 4 miles and fire at the enemy from a different place from where we normally were, so that if they decided to fire back, we'd probably be back home again. We did that quite often. Several nights a week, we would go out about 7, 8 o'clock.
How many guns?
There'd be the four of the troop.
So the whole troop would go out?
Yeah, the troop, yeah. And I remember noticing the moon, because it was a crescent moon. And the first night it was a certain position, and the following night it would be lower down and lower down. I remember that particularly. But that was the idea, to fire from a different position from where we're actually based.
And you'd be firing just on specific targets, or
yes,
just towards the Italians?
Well, there would be... they had these... observation posts, like electricity pylons, you know, and they used to observe the enemy during the day, and no doubt they'd fix some targets and then go to this place and fire at them during the night.
Would you get any return fire during
the night? Well, we never did, actually, no. Whether they fired to where we'd been, I don't know. But
was there much artillery fire at all, on, you know, when you're in your normal positions?
No, not much, no. No, not till Alamein.
So it was quite quiet.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
So what's the next thing you remember? Is Alamein the next thing, really?
Yes, I suppose so. Yeah.
Well, tell us about that then.
Well, it was.
What about the bombardment?
Yes, it was a full moon, and they all opened up at once. you know, the whole line from where we were down to the sea. It was incredible, really.
Where were you? Were you back with your quad?
Well, I was, yes, I was in the back of the guns, yeah. Yeah.
Did you have any duties when they were firing like that? I mean, getting ammunition or anything, or were you just watching?
No, not at the time, no. No. If I would be called on, obviously, if anybody fell out or anything like that, but I wasn't there, no.
So what happened next?
Well, actually, it was a very quiet end of the line where we were. I think the 50th Division was held in reserve, more or less, because we didn't actually do much sort of advancing like the rest of them. You know, we could see the tracer bullets firing passages for the sappers and everybody to go down, but we didn't actually have it on our front. The Allies were sort of held in reserve, I would say.
So you did you was it you just but you were just firing basically? Then?
Yeah, that's right.
But not moving forward.
Not moving forward, no, no.
And did you get any return fire at this stage?
No, we didn't. The Stukas came over a few times.
Tell us about that. Were you attacked? I mean,
well, no, they were attacking the bigger guns behind us. You know, the I've forgotten what they were called.
5.5.
Yeah, yes, those. And they would attack those. And when they were screaming down, you were it was frightening. But
the siren worked then.
But they didn't actually attack our position. It was just about, you know, 300 or 400 yards behind us. And but as for artillery fire, they hardly ever had any of that.
So what happened next for you?
Well, when they broke through eventually, we moved up the road as far as a place called El Adam.
That's the airfield in front of Tobruk, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yes, that's all right.
Now, what about that advance to El Adam? It's quite a long way, isn't it?
It is quite a way, yes. We advanced like ships at sea. You know, we didn't go in a one long column. We just drove across the desert in about 5 lines, and we had to keep a distance. And
what was that drive like?
Well, it was a new experience again. You see, that was all. It was you didn't know what to expect, really. You know, whether anything was going to happen or not, but it didn't. We got there intact and set up a position at El Adam. What I was going to say was, when we did go down the road, they had these boards spaced out at intervals, and it seems ridiculous now, but on one it would say don't, and then the next one be a bloody fool, you know, just like that. And that would seem strange, you know, using swear words on big boards.
And meaning
ridiculous.
What?
Pardon?
What were they trying to get you?
Well, don't be a bloody fool, keep your distance. That was the next. You see, keep your distance. You had to keep 100 yards or so behind the one in front. Because if you're going to be strafed, if you're all bunched up together, you'd be a sitting target. But it was just the use of a swear word on a big board, you know. Didn't seem right in those days.
So you went in a big line when you went across the desert, but when you went on the roads, in a column.
If you were in a column on the road, that's where they had these boards at the side of the road. Yeah.
Did you have any lights at all?
No, not. Well, we didn't move at night much. It was mostly in the daytime. Yeah.
And what was it like driving in the desert? I mean, what sort of problems did you encounter? I mean, you've explained about the ground, but I mean the other problems in the desert, like all the sand gets in your engine.
Yeah, we used to have to let the tyres down in the morning, reduce the pressure in the tyres, because when the sun got up, it would overinflate, you know, could even burst them. So we used to have to do that every morning. And
then would you inflate them at night?
Yes, you would do. Yes. Yeah.
Anything else? What about maintenance in all the dust and sand and the
rest? Yeah, well, you had to keep your oil topped up. There's something about that when we were coming back from Tunisia, but that's going on a bit, isn't it?
We'll come back to that.
Yeah. 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 They had to be well maintained. And the water had to be regularly topped up. And of course, there wasn't a lot of water about. It had about 6 metal cans on the back of the quad full of emergency water.
How did you get your water and your petrol and your oil? I mean, you know, you could carry some with you, but what about the you
well,
said
of course,
guzzled petrol.
Yeah, the supply lines were pretty good at Alavain.
But when you pushed forward?
Yeah, we never really had any great problems.
So where would you pick your petrol up from?
Well, they used to come in. That was the silly part, you see, they used to bring these 1,300 weight lorries full of these square tins of petrol, but when you emptied them out, they were mostly half empty because they'd all leaked out. You see, the flimsy things. The Germans had what they called jerry cans, and we used to have a watching brief. We had to find as many jerry cans as we could, you know, for our own use. Of course, they manufactured them themselves eventually. You know, they got a strong clip on the nozzle, and well-made tins. Our lot were, you know, it was hopeless. Most of it was wasted, the petrol. Terrible.